Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? Good afternoon. Can you hear me? Excellent. It's so great to be with you. First of all, I'd very much like to thank my friend, Pa Applegarth, who always shares a very bipartisan perspective with me. And I am tremendously grateful for his wisdom and counsel over many years. And I'm really honored to be amongst such a prestigious group of people and with such incredible speakers that you've had. So I'm really honored to be here. As Paul said, I do get attacked from both a few people on the hard left, and I do get attacked sometimes from the right. So I sort of feel like I'm in the happy middle, because given I feel that way. But I think that proposition might be tested a little bit from the conversation we have today. So what I would like to do is really spend some time, just a little time, telling you what we do at the Center for American Progress, discuss the kinds of ideas we work on in Washington and where the national debate on issues are, and then something a little bit about our role in the presidential conversation. And then I very much hope to take questions, as many questions as possible, because for me, it's really important that to get outside of the Washington bubble and to hear perspectives from around the country, and that is one of the reasons why I am so thrilled to be here. So Paul said a little bit about the Center for American Progress. I'll say just a few more words. CAP is a progressive think tank, or, you know, we consider ourselves progressive but practical. So our mission, and we started in 2003, our mission has been focused on improving the lives of people by really focusing on opportunity and ensuring opportunity is available for everyone. Many people who work at CAP have worked in the government, have worked in the private sector, and so we don't apologize for trying to think of ideas, how they will work in making change in people's lives. And the debates in Washington, and really sometimes in the debates in the national conversation, can be about ideas that are impractical, or things that cannot happen. And on our view, the most important thing is actually having real results in people's lives. And so that has been our focus and mission. And we have policy teams in really every issue: economic policy, domestic policy, healthcare, defense policy, the range of issues. And I'll talk a little bit about the topics we're working on and how we affect policy, which is we are an ideas institution. We are really trying to think through solutions for problems that people have, both directly, day-to-day, but also over the long term. In the time of incredibly polarized politics, I started in Washington, as Paul said, I started in Washington in the late 90s, and so I worked in the Clinton administration in the White House there, and politics was not beanbag in the 1990s, but there was an impeachment back then. There was also a lot of opposition, but there was an ability to try and get the solutions through. There was bipartisan budget agreements. And really, from our perspective and my perspective, it is important to think through what are solutions to problems and then how they can actually pass. So on domestic policy, we work in a practical way. We are focused on issues like healthcare costs. We believe in access for all Americans, and we do think everyone should have healthcare in the United States, but the preeminent challenge at the moment is high costs for people, prescription drug costs, high premium costs, and we've developed a range of ideas of how to address them, some of which have actually been continued by the Trump administration in terms of how we deliver healthcare in a way that's more integrated to lower healthcare costs. We have focused on ideas like infrastructure, which has been a topic that everyone has talked about but has seen little results. And over the next several years, we have been focused on issues like clean energy, climate, but most focused on how to create jobs from these challenges and address them. We are not just thinking about issues moment to moment in Washington, though. We are focused also on long-term challenges that we face in the country. And the national security space, we have analyzed that we see a rise in authoritarianism around the world. And in fact, democracy itself is under greater and greater pressure. We have a lot of discussion about Russia, but the most significant challenge in the 21st century, in our view, will be a battle of two different systems: authoritarianism, as proposed, as pushed and marketed, in fact, by the Chinese, and democracy, defended, hopefully, by America and the West. And this challenge, these two systems, are, in our view, the preeminent challenge that we face over the next several decades. Unfortunately, the conversations we have in Washington don't often address longer-term challenges, longer-term issues like that challenge. And in our view, that is one of the reasons why think tanks are so important. And when we are doing work on defending democracy against the rise of authoritarianism or populism, we do that work in a bipartisan way with think tanks from the right. American Enterprise Institute is amongst one of our closest partners, which is a conservative think tank in Washington. And in that way, we hope that we are able to actually develop ideas that can receive bipartisan support. Now, we live in an incredibly polarized time, as I said earlier. The fights in Washington, the disagreements are greater and in some ways far more fundamental than they've been in the past, not just about how much we pay for programs or whether we should do certain things, but there is an intensity of politics. I will say there's the discourse, the confrontation, the level of personal attacks is really intense. Might be better if we didn't have Twitter working in politics in Washington. But I actually see glimmers of interest and focus on long-term challenges in a bipartisan way. So, as I talked about China, there is an increasing understanding, both amongst conservatives and liberals, that China and the rise of its system, one which is competing on the global stage. China is making an aggressive argument around the world that its system is the best system for addressing the needs of people's populations. I was just at the Munich Security Conference, and China is aggressively making the case in Africa, in Latin America, and throughout Asia that their system is a better system than democracy. And they make the case that democracies are chaotic and also slow-moving to solve problems. Now, I actually think that the rise of China is a reason for stronger alliances, stronger relationships, stronger connections between the West, between our Western allies in Europe, Canada, the United States. But we see even those relationships at a greater and greater tension point. So I hope that through our work, working in a bipartisan way, we can actually try to communicate both with conservatives and with progressives that there are challenges like China that we need to think through how we solve in a way that we push against such intense partisanship and try to develop ideas that can solve them across the board. Another challenge that we face in the long term is the rise of artificial intelligence and what that will mean for our economy and jobs in the future. And it was so incredibly heartening for me to hear from the high school students who will have such incredible bright futures. And I do want to say, though I've been in Washington for 20 years, there's a fair amount of ugliness day to day, but I have worked on policy ideas that have become laws and made changes in people's lives. And in those moments, I too can see the beauty of politics. And it can seem fair, it can seem rare, and a little cloudy day to day, but there are moments where, I mean, that is what politics is about. Politics should be essentially about people coming together to try to solve problems that people have. And in this moment that I find it a little bit difficult to see those opportunities, I do think that the most corrosive element of politics today is the inability to focus on some of our long-term challenges, like a system like the rise of AI, which will create incredible benefits to millions of people, but at significant costs. So those are challenges we have to manage. When we have driverless cars, which should happen in the next 10, 15 years, how we deal with that transition, how do we ensure that we have jobs, decent jobs, for people across the board? Those are long-term challenges that I hope that we can work on in a bipartisan way with people across the aisle. But I cannot end my remarks without making a few points about where we are in the incredibly chaotic Democratic primary, where we have a lot of, we have a full range of ideas from Bernie Sanders to Michael Bloomberg, which I think is a broad perspective and spectrum. CAP, the Center for American Progress, has provided ideas to most of the candidates, to many of the candidates. A lot of our ideas on addressing deficits or tackling prescription drug costs or healthcare costs have been adopted by a lot of the candidates. I will describe one area we've worked on in great detail to give you a sense of our work. So we have worked on healthcare for many, many years. We provided ideas, it became the basis of the ACA, and now we've worked on plans that are a plan, which is an alternative to Medicare for All. So in the big debate on healthcare, there's a discussion in the Democratic primary about Medicare for All versus a public option. The Center for American Progress developed an idea that was essentially a version of a public option 2 years ago, as an alternative for Medicare for All, because we recognize that it's unlikely 160 million Americans wanted to lose their private insurance or face significant tax increases, but we do have challenges with high healthcare costs across the system. So we developed a plan called essentially Medicare Extra, which Pete Buttigieg and others have called Medicare for All Those Who Want It, which is to provide an alternative, a Medicare as an alternative for everyone else, while also focusing on high prescription drug costs. The debate in the Democratic Party right now has definitely shifted far left, but you also see newer candidates who've come into the debate, Pete Buttigieg or Michael Bloomberg, who really tried to shift the debate back to the moderate core. And this is a big discussion in the Democratic Party. CAP itself has provided ideas that we believe are practical ideas, but also still solve fundamental problems, and that is why we developed our healthcare plan. But our goal is actually, as I said at the beginning, our goal has always been to try to solve problems in a way that can pull people together, that you can create a majority for, that you can get through the congressional system, and that can actually make change in people's lives. And we live at a time where sometimes when you try to be practical, you can get attacked from the left for selling out. But in our view, the way to make change is to actually focus on how you can get things done. That has been our goal from the beginning. And I very much look forward to questions from the audience, because from my perspective, that really helps shape the debate. Thank you very much. Okay.
You're fine, no. While waiting for the questions to come up, Neera, one of the big honorarium for speaking at the forum is a couple of books on Naples, and so let me present those.
Oh, great, thank you.
And they're heavier than you might like flying back, but they're nice books.
And there's student questions, too. Right.
I don't see any, Roz, I don't see any student questions.
Oh, they're right there.
There we are. We like to make sure that the students' voices are heard first. So, Neera, what brought you into politics, and was that always your dream?
Oh, that's such a great question.
That's another reason we start with the students.
So I had a pretty non-traditional route to public policy and politics. I'm going to probably get a little hokey here, so I'm going to apologize for that ahead of time. So I have a different experience than a lot of people in Washington. I'm the child of Indian immigrants. My parents came to Massachusetts in the early 60s. But when I was five, my parents got divorced and my father left for a few years. And my mother faced a choice as an Indian immigrant. She'd never worked before. She'd gone to college, but she'd never worked before, which is to go back to India or to stay in America and go on welfare. And it was a very tough decision. She had middle-income parents in India. But in 1975, there were very few divorced Indian women in India. In fact, today, there are very few divorced Indian women. And her view was that her children, my brother and I, would face incredible stigma for the rest of our lives if she went back to India. So she made the decision to stay in the United States. And so we went from a, reasonable house to going on welfare. And but I will say there were a series of incredibly fortuitous events. First, we had grown up in Bedford, Massachusetts, which was a very middle-class town. And in Massachusetts, in the early 70s, they passed a law saying that if you were building apartments, if you set aside some apartments for low-income people, they would speed up your permitting process. Kind of social engineering. But Bedford had, this happened in Bedford. Actually, someone built apartments called Bedford Village in Massachusetts, and we were the first family to move into those apartments. And so even though we were on welfare, we were able to stay in Bedford. Bedford, Massachusetts has the 15th best public high school or public schools in Massachusetts, and Massachusetts is a pretty good public school. So I was incredibly lucky to actually stay in Bedford schools. And my mother, I remember having, being the only person in my school using the school free and reduced lunch voucher, and we used food stamps. And after two or three years, my mom got a job first at a travel agent, as a travel agent, and then ultimately, a few years later, at Raytheon, which is a big defense contractor in Bedford. And within 6 years, she was actually able to buy her own house. And I tell this story because I really think my experience and the reason why I am here, I was able to go to UCLA and then go to Yale Law School, is because I was able to go to those Bedford public schools. And the reason why I went to those Bedford public schools is because people made decisions to create programs that allowed a kid with no opportunities to have some opportunities. And so I feel, it's sort of hokey, but I do feel like it is part of my experience to try to give back and ensure that other people, other kids in that similar situation have opportunities like I do. And that is why I worked in politics and public policy, because I see the impact that public policy can have from my own experience. Thank you.
But we have a lot of questions, and I'm only receiving some of them now.
I won't filibuster all of them.
You know, I thought my handwriting was bad, but I no longer feel that way.
I could try and interpret.
Maybe some of the simpler ones first. The Democratic debates have turned into useless shouting matches. How do we fix that?
Man, I wish I could fix that. I wish I had an answer to that. I think the most significant problem we have is the media cycle of these events. And I think, you know, this happened also in the Republican primary debates. But, you know, I think the Democratic primary debates have turned incredibly hostile and ugly. But you see the problem that I've worked in the 2000 campaign. I've worked in a lot of presidential campaigns. So I worked on Hillary's 2008 campaign, and then I worked for Obama. I helped her in 2016. I worked on her 2000 Senate campaign. I worked for Bill Clinton's presidential campaigns. I think we are in a much different moment than any previous campaign because of the rise of social media and the social media ability to drive fundraising. So there's an added incentive structure to go on the attack in a debate and then drive social media energy around those attacks and then drive fundraising around that. So in this last debate, Senator Warren was pretty aggressive in attacking a range of candidates, and then that night raised $5 million, over 12 hours raised $5 million, which is almost as much money as she took in the entire month of January. So you see that kind of ecosystem, which drives a lot of candidates to throw attacks at other candidates instead of arguing for a vision of the future. And I do think it is a turnoff to the country and to different candidates, but at the same time, they are competing against each other. One of the oddities of the race is the debate, or particularly the debate on Wednesday, which I found really surprising, was that people kept focusing on Michael Bloomberg, who is not running in first, instead of Bernie Sanders, who is first in a lot of the polls. And so you do create this weird structure where they're not really taking on a person in which most of the candidates have their deepest policy disagreements actually with Senator Sanders. So I don't know how to fix it. I do see why it's happening, but it is an unfortunate development.
I think there's a general recognition that one of the major problems in the country is immigration, and mm-hmm. nobody likes what's happening at the borders. What are the prospects for a comprehensive immigration bill? How do you see it might actually work? Might it contain? Obviously, it will involve compromises on both sides.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually one of the oddities of the debate. A couple of years ago, there was a moment where we were on the precipice of a deal between the Trump administration and Democrats around more funding for the border wall in exchange for Dreamers. Allowing them to stay and not be face deportations, which is, you know, supported by 70% of Americans. That deal fell apart. There's still, I mean, even in this really polarized time, there is still very, very strong support for strengthening the borders and also giving undocumented people a path to citizenship once they've passed a skills test or can speak English and pay their back fees, things like that. So, I have to say the issue is really polarized over things like changing the immigration laws, the structure of legal immigration laws, as well as issues around the wall itself. I do think if the president wanted to get a deal on immigration, There are ways you can do that. The Democratic Congress has actually expanded border security, over-invested a lot in border security, but you could also see trying to do more around the people who are here. But I think the president has a policy, which is to be candid about it, which is to actually stem the flow of all, you know, of a lot of immigration from countries, and that is a deep chasm. There's a deep chasm between the two parties on legal immigration issues and allowing legal immigration, because that has been one of the big sticking points going forward.
I know you know many of the Democratic candidates, particularly, and meet frequently with them. But could you handicap the current?
You know, it does change day to day. So how do I start? I don't even know how to say it. Joe Biden has a lot of assets, actually has the ability to put together the broad coalition in the Democratic Party, but hasn't performed well day-to-day campaigning, so he's lost a lot of support. If he comes close in Nevada or wins South Carolina, I can actually see him coming back up in support. And I honestly think he lost a lot of support to Michael Bloomberg because people had increasing doubts about Joe Biden's abilities. And so a lot of people then moved to Michael Bloomberg, who has a lot of strengths as a candidate in the sense that he has a strong management experience. He was mayor of one of the biggest cities in the world, the biggest city in the United States. I've lived in New York City, very tough city to manage. Obviously created a lot of jobs for his business, is a self-made person. But I think people were deeply disappointed that he wasn't ready for the debate. And I think a lot of voters are looking at these debates and wondering, if you can't handle these debates, how can you handle Donald Trump? So I think that's a big question. We're in a very interesting moment. Where do voters who looked at Michael Bloomberg, where do they go? Do they go back to Joe Biden? Do they go to Pete Buttigieg? Do they go to Amy Klobuchar? Pete Buttigieg, I have to say, has been one of the strongest candidates on the stump. He's very quick on his feet in the debates. He handles the debates really well. He came from nowhere and is still on the stage. One of the questions for him is, can he put together a broad coalition, particularly vis-a-vis Senator Sanders? Senator Sanders essentially has, not unlike a previous candidate on the other side, has kind of coalesced the hard left in the Democratic Party, which is around 25%. There's four moderates in the race right now, and then Elizabeth Warren. Now, this is a big question. We're in this moment. We'll see in Nevada and into California. Warren did well in the debate in a sort of aggressive way. I think that strategy may bring some of the left voters back to her in California and states like that. And so that may actually end up weakening Senator Sanders in some way. But, you know, it's hard to know where voters are. This is what's so odd about this primary. You have voters who are choosing between Biden and Sanders, right? Two of the most ideologically diverse folks on the stage, but a lot of African-American voters are seeing really only those two candidates as their options, until Michael Bloomberg, who was doing really well with African-American voters until Wednesday night. We don't know how it'll happen after that. So, unfortunately, we're in an incredibly jumbled stage, and really the big problem is that if one is concerned about electability and concerned about the electability of Senator Sanders, the real problem in the race right now is there are too many alternatives to him, and the 70% is too spread out. And so candidates really have to drop out if an alternative is to emerge.
Do you think the failed attempt by the House Democrats to impeach President Trump was a mistake?
So I do not think it was a mistake, because I do think that the president's actions on Ukraine to affect an election are significant and important, And I have to say, I was in the Clinton White House when President Clinton was impeached. And I have a hard time understanding the standard of impeachment for Bill Clinton that does not apply to the behavior of Donald Trump in terms of in impact, which is if you are trying to use foreign interference to affect an election, that was one of the things the founders actually discussed in the Federalist Papers. So I appreciate, I do believe that removal is an incredibly large step to take, but I do think it's important for the principles of our democracy that a president's behavior has to be addressed in the process. And if we don't, if we say it never is, then what is a sanction for behavior? And I do think the fact that there seems to be, I don't know what the right word is, Vindman getting fired, other actions taken, you know, it worries me from a rule of law and democracy perspective.
Reading the question, one huge problem in America is the career politician.
Mm-hmm.
As a progressive, do you agree that career politicians are a problem? And if so, what is your solution? There are two related questions.
Mm-hmm.
Who are the statesmen and women in Congress today? And is AOC the future of the Democratic Party?
Oh, that's a great question. Let me go. I think that people who are in a job forever or too long, in any job, politics, I think if you run a think tank for too long, you should have new blood. So I definitely believe there are assets people have for being in a job a long time. You learn a lot about the job, but there are downsides. And I personally think one of the big problems in Washington is that the system is actually broken. I work in Washington. I do think lobbyists and special interests have way too much influence on the system, that the system is driven too much by, you know, people who can give campaign contributions. And that's true if you're a new member or an old member. So one of the things we've worked on and has, I think is really vital and should have bipartisan support is issues around political reform, trying to get money out of politics, limiting the influence and power of lobbyists of all kinds, special interests of all kinds, whether they're business or union of all kinds. It is a deep problem, I think, that fundamentally lawmakers and people in government listen to people who can give them contributions over voters. I think that is a fundamental part of Washington, a fundamental distrust that is bipartisan, and a fundamental challenge that people have in trusting the decisions people make when they think that the decisions are not driven by what's good for constituents, but what's good for donors. And so now I see politics is not always driven by donors. I see candidates or politicians or political leaders choosing to, you know, work on an issue that affects some of their donors despite what it means. But I appreciate that that seems the exception, not the rule in the system. And so I do think one of the reasons why we've spent a lot of time working on political reform is because we believe that over a long term that is the best way to actually create more trust in the system and the results. So I don't know that we should have term limits, but I think it's a totally reasonable option. I do think it's much better for us to try and have a system that allows people to hear to actually make decisions best for their constituents over their donors. And then the other question was AOC, and
yes,
what was before that?
Who are the statesmen and women in Congress now?
So I will do AOC first, and then I'll try and think of the statesman as I come up with the answer on AOC. So
I think the suggestion AOC might be one.
So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a person who gets incredible attention. She is going to what I said earlier about social media. She has a large-scale Twitter feed, millions of people, more than pretty, I think, any member of Congress. Any House member, maybe just a little less than Speaker Pelosi. But actually, in the Congress, in the House, she has actually very little sway. When she tries to drive opposition to a bill, which happened over the summer. There was a border enforcement bill the House Democrats were planning on passing. She didn't like the bill. She sent out a letter to everyone to oppose the bill, and she got 4 votes against the bill. So actually in Congress, the most important thing is the ability to drive other people to agree with you to do things. That weak influence in Congress is not represented at all in the public conversation. She drives a lot of media interest. She drives a lot of young people to events and things like that. But this is the dichotomy. She drives opposition, to be frank, drives opposition amongst Democrats, not support for issues in the Congress. So my view of AOC is that she would have to change. My sort of analogy for this is that Ted Kennedy was kind of a liberal lion for a long time, but decided to try to be a person who could actually pass legislation by doing things in a bipartisan way. He had passed the CHIP bill with Orrin Hatch. He did a lot over a long period of time that tried to actually make change. And that's the decision that AOC would have to make, which is, does she want to actually try to make deals to make change, or does she want to be a outside political leader? And I think she could do that as well, but it would probably have less impact on a legislative process. Because she's incredibly young, and I actually think she's very good at asking questions in hearings. But in terms of having impact on legislation, she's had pretty limited impact so far. And then statesmen. This is a really hard issue to think through who the leaders in Congress are. I will say they are fewer and farther between, and I think one of the reasons is that we have a system around our politics that drives donations and the ability to drive donations over other things. But I have seen over the last couple of years efforts, however minimal, to try and create some bipartisan support on issues. And you saw that actually on the war authorization vote. That was a very bipartisan vote. And senators like Mike Lee, who's very conservative, actually trying to lead an effort to restore some power to Congress on war reauthorization. I'm sure that not everybody here perhaps agreed with Mitt Romney's decision, but I think it was his speech was an important speech he delivered. There are Democrats who've been trying to move the debate in a more centrist direction on immigration reform. Amy Klobuchar has been one of those people who's tried to reach out in a bipartisan way. But I do think we have fewer and farther people in politics today who are actually great statesmen and have been able to kind of get out of the political debate. But, I mean, honestly, it's hard for me to say. The discourse in Washington is so angry and nasty. I mean, it's hard, we have a president who sends out tweets attacking people, and then they respond. It's a pretty personally ugly time, which has made a lot of people want to leave politics. A lot of good people want to leave politics.
Do you see a common issue where we could bring people together in Washington around certain things in a bipartisan way to get something done?
If you kind of look underneath, there have been some bipartisan bills recently. The authorization, it may get vetoed. I actually don't remember if it's been vetoed, but the Republicans and Democrats came together on the issue of war powers. So that was a bipartisan issue. I have to confess that it's so interesting thinking back to the Clinton years, because we went through an impeachment while they were passing a bipartisan large-scale budget deal that both cut corporate taxes, particularly the capital gains, but also did the children's health program. So those kinds of deals can happen even when people are politically fighting, but we're in a time now where politics has seemed like such a zero-sum game. People don't want to give a win to the House or a win to the Senate or a win to the president. It is pretty ugly. I'm hopeful that some issues that we work on, as I said, China or how to respond to artificial intelligence, don't seem so polarized that you can actually make progress on them. But even issues like election security have become bogged down in politics. Even issues where, you know, we're just really talking about stopping foreign countries from actually tampering with our direct elections at the vote have become really partisan and polarizing. So that, I think, it's a little hard to see our way past that. And also on the progressive side, you have, we have calls. We have really, it's a very polarizing debate even amongst Democrats, where you have, Bernie Sanders to the far left on so many issues, and attacking everyone to his right as sort of a sellout. It makes it really hard to get uniformity even within parties, let alone across parties. But I hope at some point we will come back to our senses and try to solve problems.
I think that would be a bipartisan hope. In the Democratic debates especially, the concept of a free higher education has been proposed and brought into question. This question comes from one of the students, so maybe worried about it by self-interest about free higher education.
No.
How did Cap feel about this, and do you have a specific plan for this?
We do. I mean, we haven't proposed like free college or ideas like that. Trying to be a little practicable, we have proposed ideas about making community college free, but also ensuring that tuition isn't, that people have the level of tuition assistance they need, that middle class families can go to college. It is, I was just learning about the fantastic public university system in Florida. Unfortunately, that's not uniform in the country, and it has grown to be a challenge. One of the greatest areas of inequality is between people who have a college degree and people who don't have a college degree. And one of the aspects of our economy is opportunity is really focused. If you have a college degree, your ability to make money over your lifetime is much higher than if you don't. And so we live in a country right now where 65% of Americans don't have a college degree. We should absolutely ensure that you can have opportunity without a college degree, but having a college degree is so central. So we believe that there are a series of steps you can take to make sure that tuition is still affordable, particularly for public universities. So we have proposed a system which allows basically the federal government with states to ensure that middle-class families can afford the tuition for public universities. So we make college much more affordable without making it free for everybody.
We only have time for one more question, so
sure.
I'll make it an easy one.
You can do a tough one.
Okay. How would you eliminate the $1 trillion annual budget deficit that already exists before the Democratic candidates' proposals are implemented? Specifically, since entitlements are part of that issue, how would you deal with that? And how long would it take to achieve a balanced budget? And you have 1 minute.
You know, actually, Cap put forward a plan a year or so ago to address getting to, I think it was over, it was not over like 1 year getting to deficit, but zero deficit. I'll go through the things that have grown. So entitlements are growing, but the biggest, the biggest increase in the deficit over the last 3 years has been from the tax cut. So, I think people can make an argument about the benefits of the tax cut, but having a $2 trillion tax cut that was entirely deficit financed has been part of that problem. At the same time, we're increasing spending domestically and on the Pentagon over the last couple of years, and this has been bipartisan. It was a bipartisan agreement to do this. that has increased deficit spending. So I think the truth is you have to do all of these things. You have to pull back on all of these things. You can reform entitlements, particularly try to address Medicare, increasing expenditures in Medicare, can change the structure of Social Security, but you also have to deal with the fact that our tax system has been, we have just done a massive tax cut that was deficit fueled, and we have to also address the Pentagon budget. I do think one thing I would say that it is important that President Trump is trying to pull back from Afghanistan and other engagements will hopefully allow us to spend less money on the Pentagon budget, which has gone up considerably. We'd have to do all of these things, lower the Pentagon budget, lower our entitlement spendings, pull back the tax cuts, maybe have some tax increases for the very wealthy, affect our domestic discretionary spending to get our budget deficit under control. But everybody has to do that, and it seems like the bipartisanship in Washington we've seen over the last couple of years has been to do what everyone wants, tax cuts, but also do increased spending. So that's an unfortunate, not the best way to end, but a factual one nonetheless.
Well, thank you, Neera. I very much We still have some great questions here. I regret we don't have more time to answer. So I'm going to give you the remaining index cards so you can pull them out on Bill Maher's and start responding to them.
Okay, great.
But
thank you.
Thank you.
Was it okay?